If you were here last week, you might recall that we kind of just got started on some of the wisdom of Jesus. And when I set off down that path, I expected it might push some buttons for folks, and it did. From where I stand, that's a very good thing. I love that. If we don't wrestle with what we say we believe, I think it's fair to ask ourselves if we really believe it at all. If we just sort of use that belief language for something that we're really just actually assuming. And often it sort of takes something that either challenges our beliefs to sort of shake them loose a bit or to help them settle in, to kind of have us go, yeah, no, even under, in the face of this, even with this in mind, I believe X, whatever that is, and it helps us to be, I think, more honest with ourselves and with people around us when we say, I believe about something. In any case, some of the conversations I had after last Sunday morning's talking bit reminded me of several things that I think are important to keep in mind in the environment of the table. These are, by the way, all positives. These are all values that I think help give the table some of its unique distinctive and some of its unique perspective. One of the things that I did last week was interpret a bit of one of Jesus' stories. And one of the first conversations I had afterward was with someone who had heard a different interpretation of that story. And I was sort of feeling like, this is awesome. Like, this is good. This is so good. And so we kind of compared notes. And I know that my perspective on the story was enriched by that conversation. I hope the other person's was as well. I don't know that, but I know mine was. And one of the reasons that that feels so good to me is because I'm aware that in the Jewish tradition, and by the way, if we're talking about Jesus and Jesus' stories, these are stories about a Jewish person told to Jewish people in a predominantly Jewish culture. So if we ignore that, that's just dumb. Like, that would just be a mistake. And so one of the things that's important, and the reason I mention all that, is because in the Jewish tradition, there is no reluctance about understanding the important stories several different ways. In fact, there is a deep, established, captured in text tradition of interpreting the stories in different ways. This is what Jewish teachers do with the stories. This is what Jesus does with his sacred stories. Now, he does it in ways that are so radical that the establishment who are trying to keep their preferred code for those stories intact and in power can't handle it, and they kill him. So you can go too far with this if you want to stay alive, right? And Jesus does. But when Jesus does that, all the Jesus character in those stories is doing is acting in ways that are consistent with that tradition, which is to understand the stories in more than one way. So that's a really beautiful thing. When you have more perspectives, you just enrich the story. And that's what happens in those conversations. So, as far as the table goes, if I say something like, the point of this story is, it's important, I think, for us to hear both what I'm not saying as well as what I am saying. I'm not saying this is the only way to understand or interpret this story. Even if I don't say all of that every time I say, the point of this story is, just bracket it for yourself. What Tim does not mean is there's no other way to understand this story. What I am saying is, this is how I'm reading or understanding this story in this telling. All right? It's that situational. It's that now. I think that's important. And one of the reasons I think that that's important is because when I think about what makes a story true, I'm not, first of all, thinking about its facts. By true stories, I don't mean factual stories. And the reason that's important is because true stories respond well to different readings. You could think of them as being alive. And if that idea feels a little bit foreign to some of us, But if you grew up around faith communities that claim to take the Bible seriously, it's worth remembering, if that's part of your context, that many people would say that the Bible makes that very claim for itself, the claim of being a living story. And if you want to look up the chapter and verse, it's Hebrews 4, verse 12. We're not going to kind of dig into that. But the text itself says it's alive. That's interesting. If we want stories to help us live better lives, and I think why else would we bother with them? Aside from amusement. But if we want stories to help us live better lives, what I've been calling saved lives, lives that continually turn away from the lesser to the greater, one of the things that we need in our lives is we need stories that travel well. And that means, among other things, that we need to be careful to not confuse ideas like facts and truth. Now, this could sound kind of hazardous, but let me just illustrate a little bit, and then you can sort of go, oh, yeah, maybe or maybe not, right? That's part of the process. I think that all we have to do is pay attention to, like, one 24-hour news cycle, and we will be exposed to the experience of having the same set of facts presented in lots of different ways by different people as best suits their purposes. So we know, just from that experience, that facts and truth are not the same thing. They are distinguishable from one another. There's lots of overlap. In an ideal world, maybe we would say they are the same thing. But by experience, we know that that's not the way those ideas get handled. And so what we need in our lives are we need guiding stories that are the sorts of truths that are applicable to a wide range of facts. We need truths that travel well. And those kind of stories are the ones that don't just survive change, but they also cause it. They stir up good change around us, in us, in the world around us, and they foster and help to further change in those kinds of worlds in our experience. So those are the kinds of stories we need. Ones that travel well, ones that are true, as opposed to ones where we go, this is just the facts. We're always contextualizing the facts. And stories that can actually stir our perspective on experience, on the facts, if you will. Now, let me give you a simple illustration from another conversation I had after last week's talkie bit. One of the illustrations that I used last week was about climbing, about rock climbing, mountaineering, that kind of thing. And I had this rope set up here as part of that illustration. And in the process of making this little demonstration that I was talking about, I unclipped a carabiner. And when you clip a carabiner, it makes this really cool little particular sound. And so I sort of waxed, you know, rhapsodic about how lovely that sound is and all these beautiful things it brings to me and this rush of happiness that goes with that sound and how that's what carabiner sounds do, you know, they make you happy. And so afterward, Aaron is like waiting in the queue and he told me I could tell this story. And he shows me his hand and Aaron has this like incredible scar that runs all the way down the side of one of his hands. And it's not like a little subtle scar, it's a bruiser. It's from a carabiner. And so Aaron's like, well, when I hear a carabiner, you know, I don't get this rush of happiness exactly, right? I remember this experience with that device. So that's just sort of the simple reality of this is what carabiners do. No, they also do that. And they do everything in between, right? So that's sort of what I'm talking about. This claim that the message a carabiner sends is a happy one is not a universal message. But the fact that an unclipping carabiner makes a unique sound and that might mean many different things, we can work with that. So that's how slippery that is. Where the action is in all of this is in the meaning making, right? What does that mean to us? How do we understand that? How do we experience that? And what do we do with that? So to get back to the other two parts of these particular Jesus stories that we just dipped into last week, my hope is that we can all look forward with some joy to the thought that no matter what take I happen to offer on these stories, there are others that will also be found in them. And my hope, as always, is that whatever I have to offer in these little bits of our time together can primarily be a catalyst for more, primarily be a catalyst for better, primarily be a catalyst for deeper. To sum it up, be a catalyst for exploring what we believe, rather than some kind of a summation or some kind of a, now we need to believe this. Just so not where I'm coming from. And I think that I wish to reiterate that frequently. The stories that we're exploring come from the wisdom of Jesus as we have it these days in what we call the Sermon on the Mount in the Bible from the Gospel of Matthew. This is the text that we were working from last week and that we'll be working from this week. Jesus is the speaker of these words as they're recorded in Matthew. And he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, trouble coming, beep, beep. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. The gendered nature of this text is not incidental to its original environment. It's a patriarchal society, deeply hierarchical. Jesus is talking to a crowd that we know from the stories includes men, women, and children, but all of the power holders in the stories are male because all the power holders in the culture were male. So we have to interpret right from go. Okay? So let's not get stuck there, but I think we need to acknowledge that that's important. So last week we explored the message of this idea of a third way that's found in that first part. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to them the other also. And that idea that turning the other cheek has at its core this brilliant piece of world-changing wisdom about how to engage in nonviolent resistance as a response to being wronged, as an alternative to just either taking it or to responding with an equivalent kind of violence or to seeking revenge. So that's kind of what we were exploring. I don't want to reiterate all that. That's the podcast from last week is up. If you want a more detailed version, that's the simplest way to find out what we explored together last week. But I want to get into this parts 2 and 3 this morning, in which Jesus says, if anyone would sue you and take your shirt, let them have your coat as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Now, as is often the case, the wisdom is in imaginatively engaging with the details because we're interpreting, right? We're not just reading it. That's why an idea like saying the Bible says as though it were an immutable fact is nonsense, because anytime we want to read a 2,000-year-old text and say it means, we're interpreting. Not only that, the text we're reading has traveled a long, long ways. It's been interpreted by lots and lots of people as it's been transmitted. And there's great evidence that people have taken good care in that transmission. That's great. I would read the Bible with the same kind of confidence about its text that I would read Shakespeare, which means not 100%. But the care has been given. You know, the confidence is not misplaced. So here's this text. Details. So first of all, this first one about the shirt and the coat. In order to kind of dig into the wisdom that's in that pithy little statement, it's important to know a little bit about first century Palestinian fashion. And I am probably the wrong person to say anything authoritative about fashion. I did not dress deliberately to make that point. I just got dressed. But I offer this insight with some confidence because I know that I'm drawing on the perspective of lots of historians of this culture. So at that, in that part of the world at this time, so first century Palestine, generally speaking, people wore, men in particular, because that's who the story's about, wore 2 layers of clothing. They had an inner garment, the one they wore next to their skin, and that's the one that this story calls their shirt. And then also an outer garment, which this story calls your coat, and some translations your cloak, and that went over the top. And the cloak was sort of like this do-it-all garment. It would have also been your blanket, it would have been your fall jacket, it would have been your raincoat should there perchance be a rainy day in the desert. And it was that's kind of what it was. It was kind of this utility garment. So that's it for the fashion part. The next part is about taxes, about which I feel quite confident as well, in the sense that I have some authority and this is a taxpayer. The people that Jesus is talking to have been conquered by and live in a country, their country, they're Jews, they're in Judea, but they live in a country that is occupied and that is brutally governed by the Romans. And as if just taking over the country and occupying it militarily wasn't enough, the Romans also taxed the people whose home they had taken over. This is probably, if you don't take anything else away from this story this morning, it's probably a story that's worth keeping in mind the next time you feel, you know, hard done by about what percentage of your income is going to Ottawa. Because not only did the Romans tax the Jews in their own land, but they were also subject to 2 other taxes. One was called a temple tax. So it's like a religious tax. They paid this to the priest class in the culture. So if we were going to contemporize this, if you were a Jew in the first century and I was the priest, we wouldn't have had to talk about that slide, okay? Because you would have paid a tax just to be part of the religion. Now, the idea of that tax was that what the priests were supposed to do was take it and redistribute it to the poor, okay? That's why it was there. The problem is that the ruling religious class, the Sadducees, had become so thoroughly corrupt that they were mostly keeping it for themselves. And one of the reasons we feel confident about this historically is because we've excavated Sadducee houses sort of on the south side of Temple Mount in Jerusalem and found what would be in our culture like $5,000 bottles of wine in their homes. I mean, they were definitely padding things out with the temple tax. So they paid the Romans a tax, they paid the temple tax, they also paid a local tax to the government, sort of like a municipal tax. So these people were paying an enormous amount of tax. Lots of estimates would say that up to 90%, 90, not 19, 90% of their income went to tax. I was in Greece this summer and met a number of people who talked about being taxed in the 60 percentile bracket. So this is not just an ancient story. That's a lot of tax, up to 90%. So what happens in this environment, in this culture, is that like good, hardworking families are losing their land. It's not like, and that's not like losing your second car or your cottage. This is how they fed their families. So they're being so heavily taxed that they're having to give up their ability to provide for themselves. And there are people in this equation who we know like to come in when they see a family that was in tax trouble, and they would kind of come in and say, listen, we can help you. We'll buy your land. So we'll make you liquid again. We'll give you some cash in the bank. We'll help with that bank balance line. And they'd buy the land. But the problem was, under that taxation scheme, that was just a short term, that was a Band-Aid. And the families, lots of these families just augured in deeper. So then what happens in that situation, if your creditor, whoever that might happen to be, is ruthless, they don't just come after you for your land, they come after you for whatever else you have that has any monetary value, including your clothes. That's what this story's about, right? So that's why the background really matters. This is Coburn gestures toward this in one of my favorite songs of his when he writes, when the wild-eyed dogs of day-to-day come snapping at your heels and there's so much coming at you that you don't know how to feel, when they've taken all your money and then come back for your clothes, when your hands are full of thorns but you can't quit groping for the rose. That's what we're talking about here. And where Jesus picks up the story is where it moves from difficult to desperate to degrading to dehumanizing. Jesus picks up the story in the part where the tax man comes to you and says, you still owe me, give me your clothes. So that's where we are when we read this sentence, okay? So far there's parts of the story we might recognize, taxes on taxes, we kind of have some idea about that. Rich getting richer on the backs of the poor, we kind of know that story. The bank taking the land, taking the house from the hardworking family, we sort of know that story in some version. But most of us can't even begin to imagine the burn of, you still owe me, give me your clothes. We just don't live there. And it's right at this point that Jesus offers what might seem like profoundly foolish advice about the best way to proceed under those difficult circumstances. If someone sues you for your coat, give them your shirt also. How ridiculous is that? So now we have the oppressed character in the story standing in public naked. How can that be a good idea in any way? How is this helpful? Well, like in the previous story, the genius is in the details, because in the first century Palestinian part of the world, the shame of nudity wasn't primarily the shame of the person without the clothing. The shame of nudity was primarily on the person who looked on that nakedness. So that's why, for instance, in the Noah story, after the boat part of it, and they land and all that, and Noah gets just pissed, and he falls asleep in his tent, naked. How drunk was this man? And his kids see him. Noah doesn't get cursed. The kids get cursed. So that's the way this worked in the culture, right? It's looking on the nakedness that's the problem, not the nakedness. And you have to remember that an action like, you still owe me, give me your clothes, happened in the public square. So at the city gate. This is where governance was taken care of. This is where the law was practiced, right? It was in public. Everyone's looking on. So you got the power holder, the person who's doing the collecting, suing the person for their clothes in public. And he says, give me your shirt. It's a public thing. He's still got his cloak. He's still got his coat. And so when Jesus says, if somebody takes your shirt, give him your coat, what's happening? Just think about this for a minute. If you're the one doing the suing, if you're the power holder. No. Wait. I didn't mean that. You just, keep the cloak. Where does the shame in this story land if the person who's being sued gives the coat also? on the suer, on the one exercising the violence. Principles like this don't come with guarantees, right? There's no guarantee that the person who's doing the suing might not be just like, yep, the hell with the shame. I'm looking on your nakedness. Give me the coat too. And that the humiliation won't just continue apace. But there is a chance. And this is the brilliance of the idea. There's a chance that the oppressor will say, no, 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 that's enough. That somewhere in this equation, that person will begin to have just a whisper, just a glimmer, just an inkling of empathy for what the experience of the oppressed person is and will change the way they act. Otherwise, there's no chance. But in this story, there's some chance. And that's why Jesus says that. Somebody asks for your shirt, give them your coat. Don't wait till they ask. Just do it. No, no, no. Stop. Enough. Enough. Oppression has to end somewhere. Let's consider the last one for a minute. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Jesus is talking to people that aren't just being oppressed by the Romans, but whose history is that they've had some marauding superpower or other standing on them for hundreds of years. Like, this is the story of the Jewish people. Somebody was always knocking them over and taking their country. They just weren't a very big player. And he knows that the people that are listening to him know that what he's saying is about the Romans. He doesn't say that, but everyone knows what's going on in the story. It's sort of like that Humpty Dumpty song, right? Do you guys know the history of Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall? It's a political story. It was a way of the peasants who were being oppressed by a particular king having their children sing something about that king's fall without ever naming what was going on. Humpty's the ruling power of the day. Had a great fall. All the king's horses, all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. All the kids in the playground, like, what are you going to do, right? So this is like that. When Jesus tells this story, everybody in the room knows this is about the Romans. He doesn't have to say it. And the reason is because what everybody knew is that under Roman law, a Roman soldier could force any citizen to carry that soldier's military kit, their pack, for 1 Roman mile. I've seen some Roman roads. The Romans love their markers. There's a marker every mile. Like, lots of them are still there. They measured things out. That's how they did it. So you knew what a Roman mile was. It didn't matter what you were already doing. It didn't matter where you were going, what your plans were. If a Roman soldier said to you, as a Jewish person or a citizen, civilian of any kind, you need to carry my pack for 1 mile, you had to do it. Not optional. Absolute imperative. Didn't matter if you were on your way to work or you were headed out for ice cream with your kids. I was trying to imagine what this is like, and I was thinking, what's it? There's no equivalent. But to be egregious about it, try to imagine an uncaring employer that insists on overtime no matter what your circumstance is, and if you say no, they kill you. Right? This is kind of that. It's that crazy. So that's what's going on. So that's where we get this idiom of going the extra mile. And Jesus says, if this happens to you, if you get treated like a dehumanized object, in this case, a beast of burden, because in that culture at that time, who would carry this stuff if it wasn't for a beleaguered, oppressed person? It would be a donkey. If you're getting treated like an ass, and you hit the end of the required mile, what you should do is keep going. You should go another mile. Well, it's sort of like that get naked in the public square advice. It just sounds so absurd until you kind of dig into the details. Because lots of times when we think about that idiom, go the extra mile, what we mean is just kind of like bring 2 desserts to the potluck instead of one. Like just do something extra, you know, right? Kind of just be nice.
An extra effort.
An extra effort, exactly. So this is sort of not what Jesus is describing here. Everybody knows this is about the Romans. Here's the thing. The Romans weren't just crazy about enforcing their laws on their subjects. They just took enforcing the law seriously, period. I mean, these are the people who refined crucifixion as a way of letting everybody know that somebody screwed up big time and they should pay attention. So they were brutal about it, but they weren't just brutal with those they oppressed. They kind of brought that same brutality in some ways to themselves. So within the Roman legion, within the Roman military, if a Roman soldier showed sort of an excessive cowardice or mutinied in some way, one of the very real disciplinary possibilities was that either within their particular centuria, their 100 group, or perhaps within their larger cohort, or even perhaps within their entire legion, Every 10th soldier would be selected by random lot and stoned by their fellow soldiers to death. This is the frame for law, okay? So just kind of have to hold that. Here's the law about carrying your pack an extra mile. The Roman soldier could only legally ask a civilian to carry their pack 1 mile. If that person carried it further, the Roman soldier was breaking the law, and they would be subject to Roman justice. So, when Jesus says, if you hit the end of the mile one, just keep going, do you get it? Like, do you see what's going on here? What's the soldier going to do? They're not ignorant of the power of Roman law. They enforce it. They see it enforced in their own experience all around them in their cohort. What are their options? It just turns the tables on violence so brilliantly. It's genius. You hit the mile marker and you just keep going, and all of a sudden, there is an empowered, brutal oppressor who has to decide whether they will dignify your choice by removing your burden or whether they will risk themselves by carrying on with the oppression. That's genius. No, stop. Take off the pack. Oh, you want me to take off your pack? Okay. I could do that for you. I could take off your pack, right? Or keep the pack on and just take your chances that your superior just walks around the corner right then. It's brilliant. I said I was going to try to connect this to what I called the Kavanaugh debacle in the U.S. this morning. I chose to do that because it had some scope as a story, because perhaps it was more top of mind. There's probably lots of stories we could choose to work with at this point, but I said I would do it with that story, so I want to do that, and I know this has gone a little longer than usual, but I want to make that application before I wrap up. Most of us, when we're wronged or when we're oppressed or when we're dehumanized, when we're sort of subjected to aggression in some way, we tend to consider, we kind of by default, one of two options. Either do nothing or do something similar to what was done to us. Those are sort of our default settings, right? And that kind of makes sense. Doing nothing, though, often leads to an ache in our spirits that we could label despair. It can lead very naturally, I would say, to a profound sense of being powerless, of feeling like we really have no options. Not a good space. Or we could respond with what our, you know, contemporary military euphemistically likes to call proportionate response. The same kind of action or violence. And it's a usefully ambiguous phrase, I think, in our culture. But what it means is of like kind. And the essential problem with that response, proportionate response, is that it keeps violence in circulation. I do not wish, in making this illustration, to try to suggest that there is a way to eradicate all the complexities of having and using a military. Whole nother conversation. However, I think this is a useful way to think about the way we respond when we're wronged. I've mentioned in this context before, I've mentioned a feminist writer that I enjoy, Bell Hooks. And one of the reasons that I've mentioned her here is because I've so come to appreciate her perspective on how to break things like the cycle of male violence, for instance, because she gets this. And she does a great job of communicating how oppressing the oppressors just keeps the core problem alive and well. All it does is it changes who the actors are. Now I get to be violent to you actually doesn't make violence go away at all, ever. And in every one of these pithy little illustrations that we've been looking at, Jesus reveals a third way, a way of thinking and acting in the face of justice that is imaginative, that is creative, and that turns the structures of power that are being misapplied in abusive ways, turns them back on the very people that hold and are abusing that power. And it does it with so much imagination that we could miss it if we didn't think about it with our own imagination in gear. Is this simple? No. The Kavanaugh inquiry. One of the things that happened in that inquiry is that lots of us experienced what happened to Dr. Christine Blasey Ford as aggressive silencing. And not least of all because her story was one of the original assault of being literally silenced, of having a hand held over her mouth while she was assaulted. One of the things that a group of women did in the course of those events that just I was thought was startlingly beautiful is they got together outside of the building where the inquiries were happening and they screamed. No content. They just screamed together. I was like, God, that is amazing. Like that, to me, I just got goosebumps because I thought, that's it. Like, this is contemporary third way thinking. This is the wisdom of Jesus in action in a contemporary setting. Why did they do that? Well, because Blasey Ford was telling a story about having no voice. And she was telling it in a setting that struck all of them and many of us as the same thing all over again, but in suits. And they were like, nope, that is not gonna cut it. This woman, other victims, many people whose stories have this in common at their base need a voice. They needed one then, and they need one now, and if they won't be given one by the structures that hold the power, we will do it. And they got together in the park, and they screamed. I think that's brilliant. That it's necessary is horrible. This is a group of people who did not give in to despair and do nothing, but they also didn't respond in a way that kept the violence in circulation. They were courageous, they were creative, they worked within the laws of the land, and they did it in a way that made visible both an essential element of the original offense and also the white-collar thuggery that was taking place in the current events. This is what I'm talking about when I say that I believe that the wisdom of Jesus is accessible to anyone. If it's true, it's true, it's true, and it doesn't matter where we find it or what name it goes by. We can all learn from the world-changing brilliance of a third way if we want to. We can all engage in the kind of creative resistance that Jesus describes in these stories, this third way thinking. And the reason I would say that we can all engage in it is because that way of thinking doesn't dictate what the application looks like the stories. It doesn't say there's only one way to understand this. There's only one way to practice this. It's an invitation to creatively and imaginatively engage in finding a third way. Not despair, not keeping the violence in circulation. A third way. A way that doesn't exist yet, because we have to make it. I think that's genius. And I think that that is accessible to everyone. You don't have to be part of a club. You don't have to be part of a religion. You don't have to have a God concept or idea to do that. And even without any of those things being part of the practitioner's story, what is true about the third way, what is true about the wisdom of Jesus, will still be true. Peace.